You're listening to the Webcomic Beacon at webcomicbeacon.com.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Webcomic Beacon here at webcomicbeacon.com, part of the Webcast Beacon Network at webcastbeacon.com, where you can check out the Web Fiction World podcast talking about web fiction, and First Issue, where we review first issues of comic books. But this week on the Webcomic Beacon, I'm Fess of ArgerComic.com, and with me we have David from BadassMofo.com. Welcome to the show.
Hello, how are you?
I could be doing a little bit better since half the people that were supposed to be on this show are not here.
Well, they may show up.
They may show up. Late.
So we're making lemonade right now, right?
They better get here. Otherwise, this will be a short episode. But that'll be just fine nonetheless. The idea was that this would be a blaxploitation discussion, learn about what the heck it is.
Yeah.
I do need to go into a little bit of history of this particular topic for the show. It was suggested, I think, a couple of years ago when a comic called World of Hurt at World of Hurt Online by Jay Potts suggested that I do a blaxploitation episode as like a genre episode. I had no idea really what it was. I just hear exploitation, and I think, that must be bad. I probably don't want to touch that. And since then, I had seen, Black Dynamite, a lot of people have seen, which is a spoof of blaxploitation. And then I've also seen a few other blaxploitation movies on Netflix, and I was like, hey, these are pretty awesome action movies. And then, of course, I have since forgotten about the topic suggestion until I met a guy named Samex. Samex. It's hard to pronounce which way to pronounce his name, but he's from a website called Ghetto Manga at ghettomanga.com, and he should be here to explain more so what he does. I had a conversation with him at Strip, at the convention in Dallas, Texas, technically Plano, but he was there, and we talked for like 10 minutes or something like that. I did record a bunch of other people there, but I recorded it too quietly, so it's kind of hard to hear, so that podcast might not ever show up. I'll try to put together a big written post about some of the people I've talked to, so at least I can share a little bit about what happened. But I was talking with Simex, and we were talking about, his publication. He would print out a collection of blaxploitation or hip-hop comics and culture, art, and all that sort of thing called Ghetto Manga Quarterly. And so we started talking about that. And eventually, I made some contact with Jay Potts, who does World of Hurt, and David Walker here, who runs a blaxploitation blog of sorts. And unfortunately, only David is the one here today. So we'll do what we can.
Because I'm the businessman. I'm the one who's always trying. I'm always hustling.
Yeah. So what we're going to do, we're just going to go ahead and start off by introducing Mr. Walker here. And so tell us about your blog, Badass Mofo.
It goes back to the early, or I should say the mid-90s, when it was actually a physical publication, back when people still did that sort of stuff, published magazines. And I started publishing Badass Mofo like in 95 or 96, and it was an offshoot of a documentary that I was working on at the time on the history of blaxploitation. And so they sort of both evolved simultaneously, and then over the years, Badass Mofo just sort of morphed into a pop culture publication. I wound up publishing some comics, and then when the internet came along, I grudgingly turned it into a website, which has gone through a bunch of iterations. And earlier this year, the site got hacked and demolished, and so I've been slowly but surely rebuilding it. So whereas I had probably like 6 years worth of archives up until the beginning of this year. Now I only have like maybe 25% of my archives up there right now.
And
it's a slow process of rebuilding, you know, like trying to find the old, you know, the old files, document files where the reviews were. And,
okay.
So that's it. So yeah, I've published a couple books on blaxploitation, and my documentary has been done for years, but it's kind of caught up in that nebulous world where a lot of the license to a bunch of the film clips and music I used have expired. So, you know, unless you like, I'm showing it at a film festival in Oakland, California later on this month. So mm-hmm. unless you go to something like that, or, you know, bits and pieces of it are posted on YouTube, most people never end up getting to see it, which is maybe is a good thing, you know? It makes it more like an urban legend.
Are you talking about things that were integrated with your old site, or are you talking about just movies from the past that might only exist in pieces online?
No, my entire documentary is up in pieces online.
Ah, so that's what you mean.
So yeah, I did a documentary. It took years to finish. I started shooting it in 1996, finished shooting the vast majority of it by 98, and then didn't actually finish editing until almost 4 or 5 years after that. It was just a long, grueling process. But I interviewed primarily the who's who of blaxploitation films. There's only, I want to say, four people. There were only four living people at the time that I did not interview, but I interviewed most of the great actors, Fred Williamson and Jim Brown, Jim Kelly, Rudy Ray Moore, some of the great directors, Oscar Williams, Larry Cohen, who did Black Caesar, Hell Up in Harlem, stuff like that.
Mm.
And, and just really, you know, I set out at the time to make what was going to be, at that point, I thought was the only documentary on those films. It turns out there was one that was made in the 80s that I didn't know about, but since then, two or three docs have been made, but they all kind of ripped me off, you know, mm-hmm. not to sound bitter or anything about it. But but by the time they got made, I mean, I participated in two of them, and then the other one, it was clear that they had somehow seen a rough cut of my movie, because it had been circulating around Hollywood for years.
Mm.
As I was trying to convince people to do interviews with me, I would send out copies of it, and as I was trying to get more money for it,
right.
and so, but through that, I got known by a ton of people. Quentin Tarantino published a book on blaxploitation also in the late 90s, and I did some consulting work on that. I think it was AMC did a documentary that I did some, you know, they interviewed me for it, and done some stuff for VH1, and so I kind of have, you know, there's me and a few other guys that are sort of the go-to people.
Okay.
When they have a question, and you know, I don't know who knows more than me, if it's me or the other guys, but the other guys, I'm always checking them, because they always have inaccurate facts, and so I like being that snotty guy who's like, actually, you're completely wrong.
Well, have you ever thought about looking at checking out BitTorrent sites and just seeing that maybe somebody has it up there in BitTorrent form?
I know my documentary is not up there in BitTorrent site, and I'm on any of the BitTorrents. I've done, if it is, it's turned up recently, not that I'm aware of. And I keep, you know, it's just me being lazy, not wanting to bother putting it up. I've kind of made the commitment that I'll have it up by the end of this year.
So I was thinking that maybe you had, a lot of that had been lost, but you still have all the files and
no, I have everything.
Oh,
I have,
okay.
What I lost was, It cost approximately $1,000 a minute to license a film clip.
Wow!
And so my documentary was full of film clips from movies like, you know, Superfly and The Mac and Black Caesar and all those movies.
Even though it's a documentary, you still have to pay these rights?
Yes.
Okay.
It's changed a little bit since then, but now it's still incredibly difficult. You have to prove that your project is, I want to say it's called for educational uses or something like that. And I know a couple filmmakers that have gotten away with it, but you still pay a lot of money in legal fees to prove that you have that. And so I had all those agreements and everything had been paid for, but it's a limited time that you have those agreements. It's usually anywhere from a year to 5 years, and those agreements, you know, will be for home video distribution or for festival distribution. There's all kinds of different rights. Mm-hmm. And at some point, you know, I just ran out of money to keep renewing those rights, and so I didn't lose the movie. I just lost the rights to legally show it or sell it.
Hmm.
And so that's a common thing. You see it, you know, 90% of the time, if there's a movie, and I don't care if it's a documentary or just a narrative film, if there's a movie that you're looking for and you can't find it somewhere, it's never been released on video or DVD or something like that. If it's a narrative film, it usually has to do with the music. It's the music rights haven't been cleared in some capacity. If it's a documentary, for instance, there's a great documentary series out of England called The Incredibly Strange Picture Show, which was a series of like 30-minute docs, you know, about like filmmakers like Sam Raimi and George Romero and Russ Meyer, and it's one of the best series of docs I've ever seen. And it's never going to come out again because all those rights have expired, and you can find it. It's on BitTorrent sites and on YouTube and things like that, because most people don't pay attention to that stuff till you get the cease and desist email, which I've gotten before.
Really?
Yeah. You get the cease and desist emails on YouTube based on music.
Oh, those are all automatic. I mean. Like YouTube.
No, they're not automatic. They're very, very specific.
Okay. Well, maybe if they're, yeah. Okay. What the automatic part is where they have, it's basically a script that goes through and listens or watches. And then you'll get like a ping, a notification. And then you can also reboot it saying that this is fair use.
And that's the thing. They have no way of knowing if. I got that. I'm trying to remember what project of mine I posted on YouTube, and I actually have the legal right and the contracts saying I have the right to use the music. But you know, you get that automated thing, and they'll take it down. I've had stuff taken down, but they don't do it for.
Did you rebuke it?
And every label, they're pretty weird about it.
Did
so.
did you rebuke it?
No. I just, it's like, it's YouTube. I don't care.
You can easily rebute it. I mean, usually if they rebute it, it usually goes back up right away. They I don't think they check it as much as people think. Like, actually, I mean, unless it's become like a really big problem. Like, I had a couple of rebutes where one was just, it was just flat out, there was absolutely nothing in it. Another one, it was a clip that I totally forgot about that was in, that had some music from somebody else. I put in somebody else's trailer that had used some Spider-Man music in it. I totally forgot to put that clip in there, but I put a review in. There's absolutely nothing in here because for the most part, it's me and another guy and a recording at a convention, and I forgot I had spliced this thing in here in post. And they let me on. They didn't double check it to see that, hey, yeah, there was something. They just said, okay, that's fine.
It's crazy, and this is, I guess we're going off on a tangent, but I had posted a trailer to a spaghetti western not that long ago, and I got one of those notices that you've posted something that belongs to somebody else, da-da-da-da-da. And I thought it was just absolutely hilarious because it was a trailer, I want to say it was a trailer for The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, which belongs to MGM, because MGM owns the rights to the movie, but there's some other company that has claimed ownership of it, and YouTube is enforcing their ownership. And so it's like, that's why I just kind of laugh at the whole YouTube thing and don't get too upset about it. It's because they don't know what they're doing, you know?
Well, YouTube's like, covering their asses is really...
Yeah, no, I mean, they're covering their asses, but what I'm saying is they're covering their asses erroneously.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so it's not that difficult for someone to come along and go, oh, I own this, and then YouTube to enforce their ownership. Which
right.
Is,
there's been a couple.
Oh, go on.
There's been a couple of things like that where even somebody that has absolutely no right, like I've seen like misspelled company names.
Yeah.
Like when My Little Pony was being put on YouTube for the first time, apparently. Not Hasbro, but Habsbro had made a claim.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's YouTube was always originally meant for, like, you.
Yeah.
You know, putting stuff up on there, and it became such a people, you know, there are some legitimate uses of fair use, and then there's just a lot of people that are just clearly abusing it. And using, you can't put a clip up there, but if you take a video camera and you video record your TV playing that,
it's like, come on,
that's not what YouTube's really for, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So that's it. That's kind of the long wandering tale of the licensed film clips in my doc. And, you know, someday if somebody wants to come along and pay to renew those clips, that's fine. But I actually have a plan to repurpose a lot of that, a lot of my actual footage, my interview footage. I will be doing something with it in the next few years. So,
well, you could always look into doing an Indiegogo or a Kickstarter.
Yeah, I thought about that, I have a couple of different projects I'm getting ready to launch on. Either or, I haven't decided which. With my documentary, the problem is, for me anyway, is, you know, it's something that's coming up on 20 years old, you know, or 20 years since I started it. And, you know, I'm going to Oakland the end of this month for the Oakland Underground Film Festival, where I'm showing the doc, I'm showing a couple short films, and then I'm doing an hour-long lecture on the history of blaxploitation. And that's great, you know. But at the end of the day, with the documentary, I literally went bankrupt making that movie. I had to declare bankruptcy in 98, and it took so much of my life out of me and so much of, you know, my financial resources that the thought of doing anything with it that requires putting more money into it is like, yeah, I would much rather focus on the future. It's like when I get a call from a film festival that says, hey, we want to have you come down and talk, you know, for a day and they're going to fly me down. Hey, I'll do that in a heartbeat. But when it's like, oh, I've got to actually, if I actually have to do something that resembles work for this thing again, it almost feel like having to go back to high school or something, you know, those episodes of Flintstones where Fred has to go back to high school and it's just a nightmare. So,
well, with that in mind, we're going to go ahead and take our first break. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit about the history of blaxploitation. This episode is brought to you by Animation Aficionados. We love animation. For the love of the media, every week we have a roundtable discussion. You're welcome to join us at animationaficionados.com. So here I am with David Walker from badassmofo.com. That's badass with Z's, I think. Yep.
Yep. Yep. A-Z-Z.
And you've been doing you have done a lot of research and interviews and such on blaxploitation, but for maybe some of the people out there that are listening that don't know what blaxploitation is, like I didn't, maybe you could give us basically tell us what it is.
It's it's basically a film genre. It's got, depending on who you ask, I say it's a film genre and an era of film because the two sort of existed side by side. And it came about in the early 1970s with movies like Shaft and Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song and Superfly, and it was just sort of this evolution. It was, revolution. It was a change in how black people were depicted on screen, and you know, you went from a very very well defined set of stereotypes of black characters in movies that stuck to a very tight script of, you know, these sort of comedic relief characters. There was never anybody really that serious. There was a handful. There were, you know, Sidney Poitier made some movies and Jim Brown made some movies, but for the most part, there was never anything sort of empowering and nothing overtly political. And then along came a handful of movies that sort of changed everything around, and it was really sort of defied defied how Hollywood was portraying black folks on screen. But most of those movies were like these sort of low-budget exploitation movies that were flying in under the radar, and they were almost always about drug dealers or pimps or vigilantes. But they were incredibly successful, like more successful than most people really understand they came along at a time when Hollywood was really like dead in the water. You look at the figures of what movies were making, and most movies were tanking at the box office. And then along came, especially in the early days, these handful of movies. None of them cost more than $1 million, $1.5 million to make, but they were all pulling in like, you know, $10, $20, $30 million at the box office, which, in, you know, doesn't sound like a lot right now, right?
Well,
but
yeah.
In, like in 1972, a movie making $20 million at the box office is the same as a movie making, like, you know, $100 million at the box office now. And so these movies were making just tons of money, and they were, again, really cheap to produce, but they played in very limited selection. You know, there was, back then, now a movie like, say, you know, The Dark Knight Rises will open on 4,000 screens, you know, simultaneously in the U.S. will open on 4,000 screens. But in 1972, there was barely, there probably wasn't even 400 movie screens. I mean, that's kind of how crazy it was, you know. And so people need to understand the history. And so a movie like The Mac might have only played in 10 cities at once. It would, you know, it would have played in the Bay Area, it would have played in L.A., it would have played in Chicago, Washington, D.C., New York City, and, you know, and that might have been it. You know, it would have played in any city that had a significantly large black population.
Because there's limited, you know, it costs money to make film prints.
Yeah, yeah. So. But there was also, there wasn't as many screens, and the other thing that, you know, again, what people don't get, I was having this conversation with somebody recently about this. Whatever city you live in right now, you know, think about what the biggest movie theaters around are. They're always multiplexes with, you know, multiple screens, right?
Right.
Well, in the 1970s, I'm going to lay a bet that none of those movie theaters existed. You know, here in Portland, where I live, none of those theaters existed. I know the history of Portland theaters like the back of my hand, and yeah, there was no, you know, no 20 screen multiplexes.
Well, not that many, but I'm pretty sure there might have been still some, you know, three, maybe six screens. I remember there was where I grew up in St. Cloud, Minnesota, there was a theater. It had to be from the 70s, I think, originally, and I think it had three screens and eventually had six screens. But
well, and most of but the key thing with a lot of those theaters is those early multiplexes were, the vast majority of them were single screen theaters that were chopped up.
Ah, yes.
And so, because I remember when the first multiplex or multi-screen theaters started popping up, and it was like they would convert the balcony into one theater and then chop the main auditorium into two or something like that. Mm. But yeah, so it was just a very different time, and these movies made a ton of money in a very short amount of time. But they also got caught up in a lot of political nonsense. They were, you know, sort of viewed as being negative, and they didn't start out being called blaxploitation. That was a term that was coined initially as a sort of response to what some people saw as the negative aspects of the movies.
Well, let's back up just a little bit here. Now, I am also familiar with exploitation films in general, just a little bit. There was, I think it was all about around the same time period, where, you know, Hollywood was so buckled down with essentially not censorship, but just not pushing the envelope. They're self, probably self-regulating or such. So a lot of people,
yeah.
A lot of exploitation films were filmed in other countries where essentially they could kind of treat the actors like shit.
Yeah.
And it almost sometimes even guerrilla filmography was being done where they not necessarily had the rights, or they were even under in countries where there was political turmoil and essentially they were bribing to film.
Yeah. Well, you know, that was, I mean, there's a lot of stuff, a lot of films that got made in the Philippines, and
right.
Especially in the 70s and 80s. But the biggest misconception is the word exploitation in film, because it's used incorrectly 99.9% of the time. exploitation in the film industry is really, that's what the film industry is. It's all about exploiting the market. And in terms of business sense, whenever you hear somebody say, how do we exploit the market, what that really means is, how do we sell to this market? How do we make money off of this market? And so if you look at like all the old press material from every single movie, I don't care if it was, you know, an Oscar-winning film from the 40s, 50s, or 60s, or, you know, a quote-unquote blaxploitation movie, if you look at the press material, there was always a section in the press kit that was labeled exploitation. And in that section of the press material was always suggestions on how to advertise and promote or exploit the movie to its ideal audience. And so a movie like, you know, some vampire movie might come out, like Count Yorga, and, you know, the exploitation section of the press material would say, you know, one of the things you can do is hire local actors to dress up as vampires and walk around and hand out handbills for your movie. You know, you could, you know, pay for radio spots, and AIP, the studio putting out the movie, will cover 50% of the cost. You know, that's what exploitation really means, right? Like, you want to exploit your movie because you want it to make money. But there's also, exploitation also means, has a negative thing, where it's like, you know, you're taking advantage of somebody, you're, you know, exploiting child labor laws, or, you know, exploiting women for their bodies.
Right.
And it's the same thing, like, in terms of a psychology, if you talk about the ego in psychological terms, it's a really positive thing. If you have a positively developed ego, you're actually a really healthy person. But if you talk about it in a non-psychological context and you say somebody's got, you know, they're an egomaniac, it has a completely different meaning, right?
Right.
It's just, it's one of those things. So with exploitation films, they always get this bum rap, but it's like all movies are exploitation movies. I mean, any movie that places an ad on television or on the internet or tries to make money automatically by default is exploiting, because that's what exploitation means. It actually means to you know, make profit or make money off of a product or an individual. And so, you know, that's the thing. It became really misunderstood, and when the term blaxploitation got coined, it was meant in this negative context. It was like, oh, well, you know, we're being exploited, and we're, you know, the audiences are being exploited, and it's all these terrible negative things. It's like, yeah, but all those movies, those are the same sort of movies that people went to see when there were white people in them. You know, it's like everybody wants to see the gangster movies. Everybody wants to see, you know, the movie about the drug dealers. I mean, like, and it's that way throughout history. Like, you could look at the original Scarface, Howard Hawks' Scarface with Paul Muni from the 1930s, and that's about, you know, gangsters and bootleggers, right? And then you look at Brian De Palma's Scarface from the 80s, and that's about cocaine dealers. But those are, you know, like, two movies that totally represent what American audiences love. They love to go see movies like, you know, The Godfather, or Goodfellas, or Death Wish. You know, most people don't want to go see, most mainstream audiences don't want to go see a movie that's all preachy and, you know, that doesn't sort of deliver the things, the fantasy elements that we want, right? We go to film to escape. There's a reason why the Avengers made so much money, you know, because we want to see things that we don't get to see in everyday life, even if it's, you know, not as fantastic as the Avengers. I mean, the Godfather was like one of the highest grossing movies of all time when it came out. And the reason why was because it was a world that people didn't know. It was an escape. It was a fantasy that they got to partake in. Blaxploitation movies were the exact same thing, but it was just, they got labeled, for political reasons, they got this negative labeling that stuck until certain people came along and decided to take that terminology and twist it around and turn it into, like, like claim ownership of it more than anything else.
All right, we're going to take a little break, just a tiny little break right here, as I welcome back Kelly Turnbull, one of my co-hosts from the punchlineismachismo.com of the Manly Guys comic.
Hello.
So, yeah, we have a person in our chat room, which people can listen to the Webcomic Beacon podcast live, typically on Sundays at webcastbeacon.com/live. And we have one of the audience members commenting on our breaks being so short. Yeah, so whatever.
to run to the bathroom and get a snack.
You have to do that now?
No, I'm just saying it's not long enough for...
oh, okay, yeah.
It's probably right where the complaint comes from.
So, as I've been talking with David Walker here of BadassMofo.com, he's done a documentary about blaxploitation, and he was talking about all the rights that go into using clips and how much it costs and how it's really not practical for him to actually release it anymore, at least at this point right now.
Yep.
We've been talking a little bit about the history of blaxploitation, and I was just about to ask him, and I will now, asking him about how was like you said that blaxploitation was a word that was just, I guess, coined after these such movies came out, used as maybe political kindling. Can you tell us about how blaxploitation was created and used in particular to be a negative thing at the time?
Oh, yeah. If there's anyone in Oakland, California listening who's going to come to my stream at the end of the month, I hate to ruin it for you, but I'll share it because it's not that well-known of a story. There was a movie that came out in 1972 called Superfly, and the term blaxploitation had never been heard or used ever before 1972. And Superfly was an independently produced film out of New York City that got picked up by Warner Brothers. And Warner Brothers, there was a independent publicist out of Los Angeles named Junius Griffin, who was trying to land the account to publicize Superfly. And Junius Griffin was also the president of the Beverly Hills chapter of the NAACP, which is, you know, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, very famous civil rights organization. And so Griffin had been trying to get the account for Superfly for his company, his publicity company, and he didn't get it for some reason. Nobody knows for sure why he didn't get it. But in the aftermath of him losing that job, he launched a very scathing attack on Superfly in particular. And because he was a publicist, he was plugged in with all of the popular black entertainment publications and black radio stations at the time. So he had a very close relationship with Ebony Magazine and Jet Magazine, which at the time were the two flagship publications of black America. And so he started using the term blaxploitation in both Hollywood Reporter and Variety, which that term is very common within, doesn't sound the same in a sort of entertainment setting. Like, for Variety to call a movie blaxploitation means something completely different. But it sounds so negative that he took that term and then ran with it and used it in talking about these movies. And so what he started saying, you know, all these movies like Superfly are really bad, and they're blaxploitation, and they're exploiting our people, which is a load of crap, because this was... the guy was an exploiter, you know, he was a publicist, but that terminology caught on, and it became very popular to attack these films. And what happened was, a lot of political leaders of the time, Junius Griffin being one, Jesse Jackson was another, Roy Innes was another, all of these guys tried to use, like, this sort of negative backlash to get a toehold in Hollywood. Because at this point, there were no black executives in Hollywood. There was nobody making decisions. There was no sort of minority quotas within the industry. And so all these guys tried to use this sort of blaxploitation facade of, you know, these films are negative, to get power. And it backfired. And Hollywood was just like, okay, forget it. We're not going to put any of these movies out anymore. And they didn't have to. You know, the movies made money from about 1970 to about 1973, 74. By 1974, they weren't making as much money as they had been, in part because, just like every other form of low-budget exploitation cinema, the genre was repeating itself. You look at the Hollywood, the slasher movies that came out in the late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah.
You know, after a few years, by the time Friday the 13th Part 5 comes out, you realize, oh, okay, you're just giving me the same old stuff. Well, it was the same with blaxploitation movies. It was the same with... They had, in the 70s, there was also something called Hicksploitation, which was, you know, eventually gave birth to movies like Smokey and the Bandit and things like that.
Well, people just eventually get tired of them, right? But yeah, I'm wondering, why doesn't that happen now? Why do we have the same goddamn romantic comedies that keep happening?
You know, I actually, like, I heard a thing from some people who worked on the Land Before Time series, and they were saying that, like, it's such a, like... It's such an easy investment. It's like you put in $2 million, you get out one. Like, you know, that was backwards. put in $1 million, get out two. It's like it's guaranteed profit. It's like it's so easy to find investors, and it's like people are going to, like, you know, it won't appeal to, like, the critics and stuff, but, like, there's going to be the audience of people who show up and watch it. It's like the same reason, like, Seth MacFarlane keeps getting shows.
Oh, no.
Yes, it's what audiences know and they recognize, and what people know they can sell. And
Sethsploitation.
Yeah, and with blaxploitation, the thing was that, you know, again, Hollywood, there weren't a lot of huge blockbusters between 1970 and 1974. There hadn't been a huge film in nearly 10 years. And when I say huge film, I'm, you know... The definition of what a huge movie was changed in 1975, and that was with Jaws, and Jaws changed everything about film, everything you could possibly imagine. It changed, and people thought maybe this was an anomaly, but then Star Wars came along 2 years later and backed up that theory, and then after that there was a succession of movies that kept proving that, oh, there's a new model, and this model's going to work. Mm. And everything else that doesn't fall within this model is up for consideration of just being either rejected or changed around. And so that was a huge part of what killed off blaxploitation films. But then the other thing that really killed off blaxploitation films was, you know, a lot of it had to do with the fact that what we were talking about earlier, which was movie theaters. You know, the movie theater in the suburb, that multiplex that exists at the mall is a relatively new phenomenon, because the shopping mall is a relatively new phenomenon. If you watched Romero's Dawn of the Dead in 78 or 79, I always get confused what year it came out, but when they first come up on the shopping mall in the helicopter, they're like, what's that? And it's like, oh, it's one of those big indoor shopping malls. Well, you got to remember, like, in the late 70s, like, those were pretty rare, you know? And so the movie theaters that we think of as now didn't exist by and large in the 70s and up until the early 80s. The movie theaters that most blaxploitation movies played in the inner city movie theaters, which most of them went away. You know, it's they played in the movie theaters that were all along 42nd Street in Times Square in New York City. None of those are there anymore. All of those by the mid 80s had been closed down, and those theaters existed where the audience existed, and then they shifted, and they built movie theaters where the audience had moved to, and so it's a really complex history, and I love talking about it. I love writing about it. But most people don't get it. You know, they don't get why the drive-in was significant to independent film in the 60s and 70s, and why these theaters were significant, and what changed. And, you know, what changed was by the 80s, all the movie theaters were owned by, you know, a handful of companies, whereas before that, you know, during the 60s and 70s, like one company might own all the theaters in Florida and Tennessee. And so you could make a movie and you could just play it in Florida and Tennessee and you would know how to make your money back. But then the moment these big corporations started buying the theaters, suddenly you had to go through those corporations to get your movies shown. And that's part of the history of exploitation cinema, because it was almost like a carnival road show.
Well,
that's really interesting.
Yeah. Another thing that can be looked at these days is, it's a different market now, of course, but there are still a lot of theaters. You know, you'll sometimes see a movie that's advertised that it's going to be in select theaters.
Yeah.
And those, I mean, they'll play to a niche audience, or there's film festivals these days. You see stuff that's not mainstream get put out. And also there's the internet. You know, there's a lot of people making their own stuff and putting movies up on Blip and other things. There's a huge independent movement now. And I think the movie niche for seeing non-mainstream movies is getting bigger every year. So I think
it's actually that's interesting, because like I went to a film festival in Toronto a few years ago. It was the After Dark Festival, and it's a big genre kind of, like, you know, they do a lot of horror movies, but there's, you know, like there's action movies and there's some like thrillers and stuff like that mixed in there. And they're actually like their big opening gala was Black Dynamite, which, you know, like I don't know if it's come up yet, but yeah, it's, you know, it's like a classic blaxploitation film made in like 2009. And a couple nights later, they showed.
I would have to disagree. It's not a classic blaxploitation movie, but
it's a blaxploitation. It's a blaxploitation exploitation.
Yeah,
it's a spoof.
That's what I mean. Like,
but
know,
it's it doesn't really truly. In a lot of ways, it doesn't capture what those movies were about. Like it's very selective in how it spoofs those movies, and it's like. It's what people, it's what a handful of people think those movies were like, and so now that's become what those movies are like. Does that make sense? It's like watching a movie like Kill Bill, and people think, oh, this must be what, you know, martial arts and samurai revenge movies are like, because this is what Quentin Tarantino tells us they're like, when in reality, they're not like that. Same thing with, like, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. It's like, this isn't what kung fu movies are actually like.
Well, no, but, you
know. Very revisionist.
Yeah, they're revisionist.
It was very much, like, making fun of kind of a lot of the problems. Like, they did a Q&A with the director afterwards, and he was talking about, like, all of the things they were trying to hit. Like, you know, like, they'd have the character who, like, his actor kept changing throughout the movie, and they were talking about, like, the number of scenes where they planned to have the boom mic drift in versus the number of times it actually happened, and how they had to, like, kind of fact-check the movie to make sure that, like, all of the mistakes in it were, like, 1975 mistakes and not 2009 mistakes.
And I just have to share this with you, because this is what drives me nuts, see?
Like, I'm sorry if I hit a nerve.
No. It's not you hit a nerve. It's that, like, because I know the guy who directed Black Dynamite, and I enjoyed the movie, and everybody laughs because, oh, the boom mic got in the shot, right? Well, the boom mic isn't in the shot in any of those blaxploitation movies that came out.
Are you kidding me?
Let me explain.
Okay.
When the movies came out on video in the 1980s, nothing was letterboxed. Nothing was in the proper scope, right? And so all these movies, I've seen dozens of them. I mean, I more than dozens. There's over 300 blaxploitation movies made. I've seen almost all of them. They showed up on home video in the 80s, and they weren't cropped specifically for the proper aspect ratio for which they were shot. So the boom mic shows up on video in all the shots. But if you were to see the movie in the proper aspect ratio, the boom mics aren't there. If you watch any movie, I don't care if it's, you know, the original Star Wars or any movie, if it's not in the proper aspect ratio, you've got a good 50-50 chance of seeing the boom mic in the shot. And the problem is because blaxploitation movies were released and poorly released on home video in the 80s, and because the proper aspect ratio wasn't maintained, the boom mic shows up in everything, and then it becomes part of the history that, oh, these movies are all bad because the boom mic was always in them.
Okay.
And that's not the truth.
There has to be – okay, there was a Dolomite movie that I saw.
Yes, and where the boom mic is in it, and a ton of shots.
No, it's not. It's not that. It's not. There's one particular scene where the fucking sound guy is sitting there. You can see all of him. Now
okay,
that,
but where is he? Where is he on the screen?
He's
off
in
to the side.
He's in between. He's sitting in between two people talking. He's like the bottom third, if not the bottom half of the shot. He's just sitting there, holding up a mic, listening on his headphones. That had to have been super cropped.
I'd have to see that because I don't recall ever seeing that shot in a movie. But
it was like on Netflix.
Yeah, I've watched movies in film festivals where, the most horrifying moment I've ever seen for a filmmaker was they showed their movie in the incorrect aspect ratio, and the sound person was in the entire scene, and it was because they didn't have the proper lens on the projector. And so you not only did you not have it shrunk down to the proper aspect ratio, you had the screen bigger than it was supposed to be, and the guy was standing off to the side of the screen, but he's clearly there.
Mm-hmm.
He's clearly there, and you're watching it, and everybody in the audience was like, "Oh my God, this is the worst movie I've ever seen. This person's so stupid. They made this movie, and filmed the sound guy," and I'm one of the people sitting there going, "Oh God, they got the wrong aspect ratio." And the woman who made the film like is crying because she knows what the audience is thinking, because that's how the audience is. We're trained to look for things that are clearly mistakes. So I can't speak to the Dolomite shot,
okay,
but I can speak to the fact that if you're watching something, especially if it was on VHS or if it's on DVD and it's full frame, and it's a really ugly mistake that you're like, how the hell do they do that? There's something wrong. But I mean, also, like, I can give you an example. Black Caesar is there's two versions of Black Caesar, and the home video release that got released is the wrong version.
Ooh.
And so historically, everybody thinks Black Caesar ends one way, and it doesn't end that way. There was two theatrical versions of Black Caesar. And the version that Larry Cohen didn't want released got released on home video, which then subsequently got released on DVD. And so it's become this sort of like, this is historical fact has been rewritten. And nobody fact checks most of this stuff. And so it becomes like, suddenly the sequel of Black Caesar doesn't make any sense because Black Caesar died at the end. Tommy Gibbs dies at the end of Black Caesar, when in reality, he didn't die. He died in one version that showed in the UK, the prints that were shown in the UK, not the US version. But it was the UK print that was turned into turned into the home video release.
All right.
Granted, they do still seem to do that these days. There's it was like some Stephen King horror movie that came out, and they the theater and like the DVD had different endings or something,
they shoot stuff different for like television or different markets, and people don't necessarily pay attention to what they're doing there. That was with Superman the movie, when that first showed on TV, it was like they showed the 5-hour version. Same with Dances with Wolves, and there's Blade Runner. There's so many different versions of so many different movies, and when stuff was being prepared for home video, especially in the 80s, the people that were preparing the stuff weren't necessarily paying attention to what version are we pulling from. They're going into their vaults and pulling stuff out. I find it all really interesting and fascinating, but it drives me bonkers at the same time.
I don't think you ever have that problem in comics.
No. Comics, they just release stuff that should never be released, So.
Right. And with that,
I was just going to say, like the when I was talking about the After Dark Festival, they also played this they did Black Dynamite the first night. But they did, I think, on like the third night or something. There was this one called Black that's kind of French Nouveau blaxploitation film that came out in like 2008 or 2009, and it was just interesting that they, because it was a serious movie. It wasn't a spoof of the genre. It was just straight up like a modern French guy wanted to make his own blaxploitation film, and so he did this one about diamond smugglers and bank robbers and stuff, and It's like, I haven't seen that one.
I'd love to check that out.
Yeah, I'll have to find it. It's just called Black. I can't pronounce the director's name. It's Pierre Lafagre or something.
Interesting. Yeah, no, I mean, there are some movies that are clearly, you know, I mean, Attack the Block had a lot of blaxploitation elements in it. And people are like, really? No, you got to be kidding. And I'm like, no, it actually did. There was, you know, you watch a movie like Together Brothers or something like that, and, you know, the fact that half the cast were, you know, black teenagers. So, yeah, you see it. You see the influences everywhere. You see, always see it in Tarantino's movies. You're going to see it in his new one that comes out later this year.
Django, yeah.
So.
All right, we have to take our last break for the show, and then when we come back, we'll finish up this conversation and then get back to webcomics.
This program is a part of the Webcast Beacon Network. Follow us on Twitter at Webcomic Beacon. Email us at webcomicbeacon@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at 1-320-310-0922. Love the show? Please grab the iTunes or RSS feed. We're also on Stitcher.com with Stitcher Smart Radio, an on-demand service where you can stitch podcast and radio show feeds together for your own personal streaming service. The Webcast Beacon Network, covering and promoting creativity in the creative process since 2007. Webcomics, comic books, news, and web fiction at webcastbeacon.com. Now, back to our show.
All right, and we're back. And just a little bit, we had somebody in the chat room ask about what this show is. This is the Webcomic Beacon, and why are we not talking about comics right now? Well, here's the thing. The Webcomic Beacon started in 2007 and really was largely a sort of like for creators sort of podcast, talked about genres and topics and interviews with people. And these days, you know, webcomics, you know, the line between web comics or digital comics and like print comics, it's blurring so much these days. And and I was thinking, you know, what was really important about the Webcomic Beacon is that we talk about comics and creating them. So, and what goes into creating them? Well, a lot of different things, a lot of different ideas. It's storytelling, and talking about blaxploitation in general. Whether or not we're talking about comics doesn't matter so much as in the topic that we're talking about and something that somebody could use for their storytelling. And as I stated earlier, like in the first segment of the show, Jay Potts of World of Hurt at worldofhurtonline.com, it's the only blaxploitation comic I've ever heard of.
It's the only one that matters.
have you seen, I guess it's not a webcomic, but Aphrodisiac by Jim Rugg?
Let me take that back. That one matters too. Jim Rugg's Aphrodisiac.
If we're talking about webcomic stuff, I guess it is kind of relevant because that was the one that got nominated for an Eisner.
Really?
But he wanted to make sure that people had actually like read the book because like he didn't want to lose for, you know, lack of like readers, so he just put his whole book up for free online, and it didn't that kind of spurn all the other people who were nominated to as well.
Yeah, that was pretty good idea, I think, because a lot of people, especially if it has anything to do with like a group of people voting on something, especially if it's like a web based people vote thing, which we can get into another time. But a lot of times, I'm pretty sure they're not reading anyone but the one that they came there to vote for, you know, sort of thing. But, you know, I was talking with, I mentioned this in the first segment, Samex of GhettoManga.com. He says he's gone and put collections of, not necessarily blaxploitation, but comics, but he was talking about hip-hop and hip-hop culture, art and comics and such like that. So there is certainly a community. He was talking to me about like some of those movies like Madea Goes to Jail or something like that.
I
see that and it's like, oh, that's just some stupid, you know, sort of low budget dumb comedy or something that nobody cares about. But there, he's talking to me about this guy. He's like, he built up basically a following, a community following in the region that he lives in, and he's gone around and made basically grassroots efforts as to why movies that this particular person does gets like wider releases is because he's shown that it's really interesting that just because I don't care about these stupid movies or these stupid comedy movies that come out, but there's apparently, and I'm not saying Madea is stupid, but you know, that's my mentality. Oh, I'm not going to like that. I'm not going to go see that movie. But there are people out there that like these sort of things. They sell, they make money, they have followings.
Yeah, they do. And I think that, you know, in terms of comics, both World of Hurt and Aphrodisiac are, they exist on opposite ends of the spectrum, but they're perfect examples of, like, Aphrodisiac to me is like Black Dynamite done properly. like it's far superior to Black Dynamite, the live action movie anyway. The animated show is pretty awesome. I like the animated show, but Jim's work is beyond reproach. Everything he's done, Street Angel's amazing. He did this stuff with he did the Plain Janes, and he's just an incredible comic storyteller. And then Jay, World of Hurt is blaxploitation. What Jay, you know, I wrote the intro for the World of Hurt collection that he put out, and when people had told me about it, I was like, yeah, I've seen enough blaxploitation comics to know this guy's, he's just another joker, just like everybody else who thinks he gets it. But Jay gets it. And it's like, that's a phenomenal comic. His art is, I think he's one of the best comic artists working in the industry today. But the fact of the matter is he's independent. He's doing stuff on the web and not that many people know him, but
yeah, we were trying to get him on the show today and I had him on the Skype, but I can't get a hold of him, so we'll try to get him on another episode, I swear.
It's the man trying to keep us. He doesn't want us doing the same, you know, being on the same show together. For the people who have listened to the first part of the show and wondering what blaxploitation has to do with comics and you know, I think that, like, if you were to look at it in contemporary terms, right now, one of the most popular characters, the two most popular characters in Marvel Comics, or one is Luke Cage, who was born out of the blaxploitation era. In direct response to it, he was inspired by Chester Himes, the crime novelist Chester Himes, whose work was seminal in defining what the blaxploitation movies would be. And Luke Cage is sort of had his ups and downs over the years in mainstream comics at Marvel, but now he's like this immensely popular character in New Avengers, and and what those movies did is they were part of a movement that redefined how stories were told in terms of the archetypes of the anti-hero versus the hero, and it was all part of something that started with movies like Easy Rider and Bonnie and Clyde and stuff like that. And that had a tremendous impact on the storytellers who would become like today's best comic writers. You know, a guy like Ed Brubaker, these are the movies that he was watching when he was younger. Matt Fraction, you know, same thing. These are the movies he was watching, understanding, and really influenced them as storytellers, you know? They're all tied together. It's just that most people don't, you know, most people have trouble finding the connections or looking for the connections, and they're more, you know, concerned with just whatever it is they're interested in. Like you were talking about with the voting. Well, I just came here to vote, you know? It's just like, I just came here to read Batman, you know?
I kind of want to ask, what are some quintessential aspects of a movie that would make it blaxploitation? You know, a lot of things that I haven't seen all 300 or so blaxploitation, but I've seen only a handful, and common themes are usually very urban or low-class sections of town settings. You know, you got, not always, but there's a lot of times, you know, the white man keeping the brother down, so to speak, or controlling things, pushing those drugs and or domestic violence gotten out of hand. What are some real quintessential things that really make blaxploitation blaxploitation?
It's one thing and one thing only, and it's that that the hero of the movie was a black person, either a man or a woman. It didn't matter if it was Pam Grier and Foxy Brown or Fred Williamson in Black Caesar. That's what it was about. It was about, and it didn't matter if they were a good guy like Shaft, who was a private detective, or if they were a drug dealer like, you know, Priest and Superfly. The central character was, you know, a black person, and in some cases they might have been the only black person in the entire movie for the most part, you know. Slaughter is like that. And that's it. But the key is, and what people don't get, is like movies like that did not exist, period. They did not exist before the 1970s. You got a handful of movies like In the Heat of the Night or something with Sidney Poitier, but you know, a couple years ago, Denzel Washington made a movie called American Gangster, which was essentially a remake of Black Caesar. And you know, and then you look at Will Smith's career. Will Smith wouldn't have a career if it wasn't for blaxploitation. It's like it's not an opinion. It's a fact. But Eddie Murphy never would have had a career if it wasn't for blaxploitation.
Well, it's really interesting when you look at movies these days where they say like it's such a huge, like apparently it's such a huge financial gamble for a studio to make like an action movie with a black lead, that like, you know, they talk about how just impossible it is to find funding for these things. Like that was you know, when they were talking about that, what was the movie, Red Tails, that came out earlier this year? Like, you know, it was like a fun, corny kind of World War II movie, and they said like it was impossible finding just like kind of funding and people willing to, I guess, not produce it, like publish it or distribute it, because they were saying like, you know, oh, it's going to be like an overseas failure and stuff, but like
they're liars. It's a huge lie.
Like, I don't know where in Hollywood, because, you know, like, obviously there's, like, a pretty rich history of, like, black action heroes, and I don't know where Hollywood had that drop-off where they just, like, flipped the switch and decided, like, okay, black people don't sell movies now.
They've always felt that way, and they've always done that, but you look at the career of Will Smith and how much money he makes, and it flies in the face of all that. You look at Eddie Murphy's career, and Eddie Murphy's movies... Eddie Murphy will make a movie in the U.S. that makes nothing, and then it still makes, you know, it's a multi-million dollar blockbuster overseas. Denzel Washington's movies make money.
Right.
It just comes down to this is a pervasive mindset that dates back to you have to remember that there's people running studios in Hollywood that are the sons and the grandsons of the same people that were running the studios in the 30s and 40s. And so they think this way, and it just becomes this perpetual... You know, you know, the problem with Red Tails was the script wasn't good. You know, when George Lucas is running around talking about how he couldn't get anybody to fund it, so he had to fund it himself, it's like maybe if you had a good goddamn script, someone would have put money into it.
Right.
And, you know, and I saw Red Tails. It wasn't a terrible movie, but it was like it was so offensive to me that – you know, you have a guy going, oh, black Jesus, save me, black Jesus. And it's like, you're kidding me, right? Like, you've got characters in your movie, it's 2000, when did this come out? 2012. And you've got characters talking like it's like 1942, not reality, but 1942 movies. You've got Step and Fetch It in your movie. And that's therein lies the huge problem. It's the same. They say the same thing about women too. It's like, oh, you know, movies with other than romantic comedies or certain types of dramas, a movie with a woman in the lead is never going to make money. And it's well, maybe it's the type of movies you're making that aren't going to make money, as opposed to, you know, a really good kick-ass film.
Or the script and characters.
I'm very familiar with all this kind of stuff like that. I mean, I work in animation, so there are most studios you take them to. Like if it's not, you know, like a white male like in high school or something is the hero, they'll be like, you know, is it important that they're not white? Well, okay, make them white. Is it important that they're not a woman? Well, or like, yeah, is it important that they're a woman? Like, well, don't make them a woman then.
Yeah.
Well,
it's that path of least resistance.
I wanted to talk about Will Smith a little bit. Yeah. Now, I don't mean to push any buttons here, but a lot of people will say that like Will Smith is a pretty white black man, so to speak. He's a non-threatening black man.
You know what? Those people. Before you go any further, I can just tell you, those are people who either don't know enough black people or are complete racists.
Yeah, I think Will Smith is awesome. I love every movie. I love Fresh Prince, you know, that sort of thing. And to be honest, you know, as far as like what at least has been put out there, maybe it's like a lot of, you know, he doesn't seem as street or urban, you know, it seems
like the same kind of people who complain that like Ellen isn't like enough of a lesbian or whatever. You know, they're like, oh, you like her because she's a safe lesbian because she's pretty and whatever other totally offensive, like, non-lesbian stereotypes.
Yeah.
It's pretty, and those are, you know, they said the same things about Michael Jordan when, you know, oh, he doesn't talk like other black people. They say the same thing about Barack Obama as long as it suits their needs. But it's like, you know, Will Smith and Denzel Washington, there's always these people that are the exceptions. You know, they're not like the others. And it's like, well, I grew up in a family where everybody was like this. You know, everybody talks like I talk in my family. We all, you know, are college educated. We're all, you know, hardworking Americans. The media is good at pushing, you know, a certain image, a certain type that people are comfortable with.
Right.
And so if you see the same thing with, and it doesn't matter if it's black people or if it's Asians or Latinos or women, it's like there's archetypes that the media is comfortable with selling, and they've become so comfortable selling them and people become so used to it that if anyone defies that, it's like whenever you see these pictures on the internet of like a plus size model, and everybody's like, oh, it's so wonderful to see, you know, a plus-size woman who's proud of her body. And you're like, plus size? This is what women look like, you know?
Yeah.
Like how many of us know that size zero, scrawny supermodel? That doesn't exist. And so,
like, granted, it is, you know, nice to see when he's proud of their body because that's such a pervasive issue.
Right. I mean, it's nice to see, you know, average, normal-sized women in competitions like that regardless. You know, it's like...
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, there's...
And so, culturally, societally, we have just skewed perceptions of who we all are. You know, racially, sexually, you know, gender-wise, there's stereotypes that we recognize and we think, oh, this is what a sexy woman is supposed to look like, and it's like, no, that, like, who says that? You know, who are the arbiters of those definitions? This is what black people are supposed to dress like or sound like. This is what Asians are supposed to be like, And in reality, we're all far more complex than those, those sort of things. And that just drives me, and it makes me sad, too, because it's like, this is what we're teaching our kids and our children. You know, I have a friend whose daughter's like 5, and they were, you know, going to the beach for the weekend, and she wanted a bikini and high heels. And I'm like, what kind of 5-year-old wants a bikini and high heels? And it's not any fault of her parents. It's the fault of, this is what society tells young girls they're supposed to be.
Who wears high heels to the beach?
Exactly. But she's 5, you know? She doesn't know, and she doesn't, you know, all she knows is what she sees, you know, what's inundated, even when she, you know, as a kid, she's just peripherally watching stuff, you know?
Yeah, I see children in, like, department stores wearing those shorts, like, I'm talking children. Actual
yep.
children, not preteens, children wearing short shorts where I can see the bottom of their butt. And I'm like, first off, I want to yell at the parents. It's like, you let your daughter wear that? Then I'm like, who the fuck is manufacturing these things and getting away with it? I mean, jeez.
Well, that's like my earliest image of kind of like self-awareness in my head that I have when I was like, you know, kind of 2 years old or 3 or whatever, you know, just, you know, sort of like, it's sort of like the first time you remember like looking in a mirror and realizing like, oh, that's me. I just remember thinking like, that's not what women are supposed to look like, you know, like girls don't look like this. And it's like, just because that's not what you see anywhere.
Yeah.
And we see it in comics, too. You know, we see it now in, you know, comics just sort of, it all feeds off of each other. You know, there's sort of this ideal of what a superhero is supposed to be. I see it now, like, you know, in mainstream comics. Marvel just relaunched, you know, Captain Marvel, and they've got, you know, Carol Danvers in this new costume, and people are complaining because it's like it's not revealing enough, or, you know, her boobs aren't big enough or something. And it's like really? Like, you know, kids actually do read comics. You know, maybe we don't want to, like, hypersexualize women this way. Maybe we want to have a good, you know, positive female role model for, you know, so our daughters and our sisters might get into comics, mm-hmm. you know, might get into reading. And it just, it always cracks me up, you know. But yeah, you know, it's I think it's part of the reason why we haven't seen a Wonder Woman movie yet. It's because they can't reconcile how to sell Wonder Woman to a mainstream movie-going audience without sexualizing her the way they do in the comics. And it's like, because that isn't going to fly in a, you know, unless they're making a movie just for, you know, preteen boys to jerk off to or something.
Uh-huh.
So.
Well, it's the same, like, movies and comics and all that go through the same things like video games do, like, where, you know, it's like all these video games and comics sometimes feel like they're sort of, like, just barely stilted off each other. Like, they kind of, like, just, you know, they're around the same stage of, like, just being respected as, like, maybe a legitimate medium. Like, you know, like, comics seem to have gotten there, like, a couple decades earlier. But, you know, I feel like video games are going through, like, right now what comics did in the 90s. And whereas, like, yeah. You know, all the guys are hyper-masculine kind of space marine types, and all the girls are whatever you call a Liefeld girl. And
yeah. And I just kind of laugh at it all. And you know, but I'd like to see, you know, more greater diversity in all platforms, mm-hmm. whether it's video games or animation or comics, especially comics. I'm a huge comics mm-hmm. fan. You know, I've got my, I've got a book coming out through Dark Horse later mm-hmm. this year. I've got two mm-hmm. books coming out next year, and you know, and that's it. It's like I'd love to be reading comics that are in some ways like what I was reading as a kid, but in other ways are different, so that there is a greater amount of diversity in the characters and the stories, and that are more inclusive, you know, because there's no reason why there shouldn't be room for more people, you know. It's not that's where I get up on that.
I almost feel like you saw, it's like you saw more diversity, it seems like, in like the 90s in television. Just like, I don't know if it's just because so many of the networks were new back then, that they were just kind of like throwing everything to the wall and seeing what sticked. And then they, you know, finally the kind of network, like, number crunchers got in there and said, like, okay, this is your audience, just sell things to that specific audience. But, like, you know, if you look at, you know, like Nickelodeon in the 90s, and they had, you know, they had, I don't know, every show was going on, like, with such, like, a kind of ensemble cast. They had, like, the Mystery Files of Shelby Woo, so it's, like, you know, an Asian female detective, and it's, like, you yep. don't get stuff like that on Nickelodeon these days. It's all, like, look, here's some teenagers, and they sing.
Not only does it go in cycles, but it's also, it goes into the sort of the path of least resistance, and, it's, in a lot of ways, it's easy to launch something when you sort of have that diverse cast, because you draw in an audience that's so starved for itself to see itself, whether it's Asian kids or Hispanic kids or Black kids.
That makes
sense.
You know,
on Nickelodeon, you use that as an example. And it's like, I remember there was a show on the Cartoon Network several years back called Secret Saturdays, where every parent I knew who had Black kids or biracial kids were like, oh my God, you got to watch Secret Saturdays, you know? And it was like, that was what every parent wanted their kids to see, because it had a diverse cast, you know? And then that brings in an audience. And then at some point they just sort of abandon that audience and go, okay, well, they're here. We saw that with the early days of Fox, the Fox network, when they built themselves up with shows like, you know, In Living Color, 21 Jump Street, which had a really diverse cast, you know. I mean, and then you see the 21 Jump Street movies.
Yeah, I remember watching In Living Color over Saturday Night Live, and they would be playing at the same time. I would still like, I would have like them both on last channel, so I'd flip back. Because on both of the shows, I never cared about the music segments, so I would always switch back.
There were like a lot of sitcoms back in the 90s that were very positive images of like, you know, just cohesive black families that, you know, like very healthy relationships, and they were like well off, and it was, you know, it was just like, it wasn't like whatever this kind of Hollywood image that, you know, like this is what you're allowed to use black people for in your movies. Like it was, you know, there was the Cosby Show and there's Fresh Prince and there is, was it Family Matters and things
and
like that. And
Different World, all that stuff. And it becomes frustrating when and comics are, you know, even more, again, more of a sort of desert landscape, which is, you know, when I first saw Jim Rugg's stuff, like, I thought for sure, this must be a black guy making these comics. He must get it, you know? And then I met him, and I was like, well, he still gets it. I still love his book, you know? And Jay Potts is, you know, he's doing his stuff, and it's great. And I'm always looking for stuff like that. I'm always looking for something that, like, you know, there's a book coming out later next year, I guess, called Molly Danger, which is about a 12-year-old girl, like, secret agent. And that's, you know, like, most of my friends have daughters, so, you know, and fortunately I've gotten them all into comics over the years by buying them, you know, various different things, and I'm always excited when I can find something to share with them that's not going to make me embarrassed, you know, or not make me worry, like, are they going to want to grow up to be, like, a woman, you know?
I want to bring this back, because we got to close the show off soon.
Yep.
To, you know, the internet is a place now where we can find all these. You just have to put in a little bit of effort, and you can find some spectacular things. Even people that are going independently publishing comics, you can usually buy their ebooks. There's this comic, I haven't gotten it yet. I'm trying to find the actual comic books versus the collection, because that's me. But there's this comic called Princeless. It's about this princess that was, you know, is in a tower and is waiting to be rescued, sort of thing. And the guy, the is also like a kid prince with her. He shows up in his shining armor and he's like, fair maiden, I'm here to rescue you. And it turns out the princess is a black girl. And she calls him out on this. It's like, do you even know what fair means? Like, fair maiden? It means, like, you know, fair of skin is like, you know, so it's kind of like this sort of, like, bucking the system sort of thing. Is like that may not have, like, a wide release. It did also get nominated for an Eisner, I think, as well. It's nominated for some awards, so it's, but you
was
see.
Was it collaborative? Like, it had a bunch of different artists and stuff working on it, didn't it? Or were they just doing, like, I thought it had a bunch doing, like, all the different stories. Didn't Jules Rivera from Marsh Rocket and Valkyrie Chronicles, like, do something on it?
I'm not 100% certain, but the point, you know, still stands. There are people out there really trying to make a real difference. And if you look for them, you know, they're out there. You know, that's the thing. If something's not out, if something's not good, you know, to your palate, you know, support somebody else in their endeavors, or create something of your own. And that is why the internet is so great these days. You can find really positively empowering stories that feature the not typical sort of white male fantasy, basically.
You can find all the stories that they didn't have to beg for, you know, some Hollywood producer to give them funding to make. Like, you know, it wasn't designed by a committee to make it as, like, you know, kind of, I was going to say non-denominational, but I guess, like, the one denomination.
Right. Yeah, it was Eisner nominated. I just found a Bleeding Cool article on it. So
yeah, and it's funny because I'd never heard of Princeless till just now. I just looked it up, and I'm like, oh, okay. I got to go. I'm going to have to buy copies of this but this is awesome, because this is how we find out about these things, mm-hmm. you know, And it's like, I'm actually looking to see, is the trade paperback actually out yet? And if so...
I think it is.
Yeah, this is like, no, you know, I'll do some research and oh yeah, I was just solicited in, it comes out in February, it looks like. All right, yeah, I'm going to have to order this. This is, oh no, it already came out. I'm going to have to order this or pick it up or something. This is pretty cool. But yeah, see, this is how it happens. But it also takes people doing that research, and I know we need to go, but, doing that research and sharing with other people. So it's like, it's not enough that you discover it on yourself, or you discover it yourself. You've got to meet other people and tell them about it, and sometimes put it in their hands. You know, I'm famous for buying multiple copies of stuff and just handing it out to people, because some people, oh God, I don't want to look for this. You know, and it's like, just please, come on. So,
yeah,
wow, this is cool. Princeless.
And I'll try to remember to put this link in the show notes so people can see what we're talking about, as well as you can grab a link to World of Hurt, as well as Ghetto Manga, and I'll try to get J-Potts on for another show, at least an EP, a nice short episode where we can talk about his comic and whatnot, since he was supposed to be here. I don't know what happened. Hopefully everything's all right.
Maybe he was up late animating too.
No, I like talked to him literally like 5 minutes. I said, it's like, all right, cool. I got David on the phone here. I'll call you back in 5 minutes. And I can't get a hold of him. So I was like,
dimensional rift kicked up.
Yeah, probably. So we'll do with that. This has been a great episode. It's been a little long, but
yeah, I'm sorry I missed half of it, but it's been super like informative, just what I've been here for.
Yeah. So, some people might be hearing this, later than when we recorded it. We are in the midst of moving servers, and some of it is, there was this our virus or hacking that went on. All of Blind Ferret went down, which is WordPress based. So, it had to happen while I've been transferred over, so my FTP privileges got locked down because they're trying to make sure everything's good before putting everything back up online, so there's going to be some delay. There's actually two other Webcomic Beacon episodes waiting to go up, so this particular episode might not see publication for a few weeks yet, so... So hopefully everything, by the time you listen to this podcast, it's all sorted out, and we're hopefully at our new location. Until then, I'll probably make an official announcement as soon as everything is sorted out. But this has been an episode of the Webcomic Beacon at webcastbeacon.com. And again, we've had Kelly Turnbull from thepunchlineismachismo.com of Manly Guys.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for letting me in.
Like, yeah. You eventually showed up. Yeah, you're taking up the Tanya's seat fairly well by showing up really late.
I don't have a kid. I can't like, you know, blame it on, you know, that. It's just no. I was.
Yeah, it's early.
Yeah.
And of course, thanks again to David Walker from BadassMofo.com. Thank you very much. It's been a great episode.
Thank you.
And I've, of course, been Fess from ArcherComic.com, and we'll see you next time.